Chapter 20. Armed with hatred. Instead of rifles, machine guns, and cannon, which in the last analysis accomplished nothing, the leaders of the Entente would resort to the weapon of the powerless, hatred. Hatred is the spice that makes a rotten or tasteless political stew almost acceptable. The Allied governments would use it to season every bellicose appeal, every chauvinistic tirade, and every line churned out by the propagandists, so that every foot soldier mired in mud, or foreign replacement they sought to draw into their hellish cauldron, would firmly believe it was a matter of his own honor and the dignity of mankind that Germany be crushed, and that the sadistic Kaiser, that sawed-off dwarf grimacing beneath his crested helmet, be boiled in oil. Before August 1914, the propaganda peddlers had depicted the German people as a tribe of cannibals. Even Maurras, the most cultured French politician of his time, would be so carried away as to denounce the innate savagery of the instincts of flesh and blood of the Prussians, while Bergson, the eminent philosopher, would discover, in the brutality and cynicism of Germany, a regression to the savage state. Clemenceau would write, Grandeur et misère d'une victoire, page 334, I wish to believe that civilization will carry the day against savagery, and that is sufficient for me to rule out the German from a life of common dignity. He added. The insufferable arrogance of the German aristocracy, the servile genius of the intellectual and the scholar, the crude vanity of the most well-adjusted industrial leader, and the exuberance of a violent popular literature conspire to shatter all the barriers of individual as well as international dignity. William II, of whom the French military attaché in Berlin had written, I am absolutely convinced that he is for peace, in the writings of this same Clemenceau became an unnameable piece of imperial degradation, and Germanic civilization became only a monstrous explosion. The following effusion is typical of the crude nonsense of which the most celebrated French politician of the First World War talked when he was describing the German people. Every now and then I have entered the sacred cave of the German religion, which, as we know, is the beer garden. A great nave of stolid humanity where may be heard swelling amid the stale odors of beer and tobacco and the familiar rumblings of a nationalism sustained by the bellowing of a brass band and carrying to the highest pitch the supreme German voice, Germany over all. Men, women, and children, petrified before the divine will of an irrepressible power, foreheads lined, eyes lost in a dream of the infinite, mouths twisted by the intensity of desire, in great gulps they all drink the celestial hope of unknown fulfillment. That was the way a government leader in France represented Germany in the 20th century. Despite the fact that Germany overall, Deutschland über alles, in no way meant a Germany over everything and everyone, but merely over the numerous petty regionalisms that in the preceding century were still often opposed to a unified German nation. State. Educated people knew that. For Clemenceau, however, the most important nation of Europe was just a conglomeration of buffoons, gluttons, and drunkards capable only of the eternal violence of fundamentally savage tribes for purposes of depredation by every means of barbarism. Clemenceau, page 88. Once the war began, in August 1914, it was a matter of fanning this bitter scorn to white heat, then transforming it into irrepressible hatred. Colonel de Grandmaison even exclaimed, "Let us go too far, and that will perhaps not be enough." Apocalyptic pictures were painted of German heinousness so that every soldier would be truly convinced that he was fighting against the supreme horror, against evil. The campaign quickly spread abroad, in order to arouse the terrified indignation of the whole world against the Reich and, above all, to bring about the foreign military enlistments that would end in glorious non-French deaths in Champagne, in Flanders, and in Artois. The most fantastic of all the calumnies launched was the story of the cut-off hands. Today no supporter of the Allies of 1914-1918 would dare to drag out that moth-eaten canard, so thoroughly has it been refuted. Yet that sinister tale went around the world. According to the Allied propagandists, in August of 1914 the Germans cut off the hands of thousands of Belgian children. Descriptions of these abominations found their way to the uttermost ends of the earth and were a factor in the U.S. entry into the war in 1917. In Italy, in 1915, the shops selling church ornaments sold statuettes of a little Belgian girl with her hands cut off, holding out her arms all bloody to Christ's mother, "Holy Virgin, make them grow again." Benito Mussolini himself told me one day how one of the most important political figures on the side of the Allies, Emil Vandervelde, had used that argument on him to convince him of the Allies' righteousness and Italy's duty to join the war. Here, word for word, is what the fascist leader told me years later, when he was at the summit of his glory. One fine morning in the spring of 1915, Emil Vandervelde, head of the Belgian Socialist Party and then president of the Second International, came to see me. The Allies sent him to me as they already had Marcel Cachin, the future head of the French Communists. Back then, we were party comrades. I received him. He reeled off his arguments in favor of Italy's participation in the war on the side of the Allies. It was then that he began to explain to me in great detail the story of the children with their hands cut off by the Germans. That made an impression on me, and he realized it. "Mussolini," he said to me, taking me by the coat, "you're an upright man. Do you really believe we can let such frightful crimes go unpunished, and that you don't have an obligation to join us to fight the country that commits such atrocities?" He stopped, looked at me as though he had been crucified. I reflected an instant. "Yes, Vandervelde, what you tell me is appalling. It is obvious that such monstrousness must be suppressed. But tell me yourself, Vandervelde, have you witnessed a single case of cut-off hands? Have you seen any? Do you know any men of complete reliability who have seen it?" Vandervelde drew himself up, quite taken aback. "Mussolini, your question astonishes me. This affair is so obvious to me that I've not given it a thought. No, I do not know of any case personally, that's true. But there have been thousands of them. You shall see, I'll bring you a complete file." 2 months later, Vandervelde turned up in Italy again. Something appeared to be preying on his mind, and he was anxious to speak to me at once. "Mussolini, you remember our conversation about the cut-off hands? I shouldn't like to be dishonest, nor to have tried to mislead you. I promised you I would, and I did make a search. Ah, well, here it is. I interrogated people everywhere, and I didn't find a single case. Nowhere did anyone tell me where I could find someone who knew of a case. I let myself be influenced. But I don't want you to believe that I wish to influence you in turn. That story, I am now convinced, is without foundation. I owed you the truth. There it is." Vandervelde was propriety itself. Learning that he had been deceived, he recanted. But he was one of the very few Allied propagandists to do so throughout the First World War, or afterwards. That gigantic slander in particular poisoned the minds of millions of persons of good faith. Since the war, Allied historians have had several decades to repeat Vandervelde's investigation on a scientific basis. No one has ever found a single child, Belgian or otherwise, who had his hands cut off by the Germans. As if after the defeat of Germany in 1918, one mutilated youngster wouldn't have been exhibited all over the world if he could have been found. Nobody. Nothing. A complete lie. It is often said that where there's smoke, there's fire. There had not been any fire, nor even any smoke. The slander had been made up out of whole cloth, with supreme propagandistic cunning to besmirch the opponent and make him hated. Since then, there have been many other examples of this sort of base atrocity propaganda, but this remains a classic case of a total, enormous lie spread throughout the entire world, painting a people black for years afterward. There was also the story of the candy. In 1914, if one was to believe the Allied propaganda, the Germans had handed out poison candy everywhere, as if they had been confectioners rather than soldiers. In 1940, this anti-German myth would be served up for a second time. In May of 1940, Le Figaro, the most responsible newspaper in France, would even give the exact dimensions of the poison candy, 17 by 17 by 5 millimeters, on its front page. To be sure, none of this famous candy ever put in an appearance either on Figaro's table or anywhere else. It was a particularly idiotic tale. It is hard to know how poison candy could have helped the Germans in their offensive in 1940 or in 1941. Those sugary fabrications served up a thousand times in the French and then in the world press, like the stories of the cut-off hands, did more damage to the Germans than a million shells. The great majority of people are naive and will believe anything when it is printed in black and white. The story will be repeated and repeated ad nauseam. It becomes a mass hallucination. Almost inevitably, the hearer is stirred to a fever pitch and completely convinced. The propaganda of the Allies was awful in its cynicism, in its unlimited exploitation of lies so flagrant they would have been unbelievable in normal times. Decent men let themselves be hoodwinked just like the rest. Misled totally by such compelling falsehoods, millions of naive people began to snarl in hatred. During my youth, I believed in those lies totally, just as I believed the historical lie of the exclusive responsibility of the Germans for the Great War. On the other hand, the Pan-Slav provocateurs, and swindlers like Poincaré, were to us heroes comparable to heroic and chivalrous knights. From Paris and Brussels down to the tiniest hamlet of Belgium or France, we were all overwhelmed by that mendacious propaganda. It was so intensive that it was impossible not to believe it. The Germans were monsters that had become dogma. Yet those of us in the occupied areas, with front row seats, so to speak, saw the Germans at close range. They were often courteous and generally affectionate to the children. No doubt, they were thinking of their own children. I remember especially Christmas, 1917. German officers had requisitioned all the good rooms in the large house in which I was born. We seven children had to move into the attic, up under the roof. For us little Christians, Christmas meant the nativity scene, represented by a creche. Consequently, we were intrigued by the passage through the great family hall of a fir tree, which an officer then set up in his room. He was a plump little man, round as a barrel, from my parents' brewery. By peeking through the keyhole of the door to the German's room, we saw the tree all ornamented with stars, with colored lights, and with packages. On Christmas Eve, the officer, for the first time in the 6 months he'd been staying with us, gave a few little knocks at the entrance to the living room. He addressed my mother ceremoniously, "Madam, it is Christmas, and I have made up a few little gifts for your children. Will you permit them to come and take them off the tree?" My mother was very gentle. She spoke German, and was not eager to offend the foreigner. Nevertheless, we children, bewildered, heard her say solemnly, "Monsieur, you well know that our countries are enemies. Please understand that our children cannot possibly receive presents from an enemy." The poor man made a polite little bow and withdrew. We, the little ones, who had glimpsed the mirage through the keyhole, were crushed. That's the way things were. One didn't associate with the enemy, even if, like my youngest sister, Suzanne, you were only 6 years old. The longer the war continued, the more we were all affected by the worldwide wave of hatred. We believed any story whatsoever. We were eager to believe. For some years, those improbable calumnies left a mark on me, even when I was studying at the university, when the most elementary examination of history ought to have enlightened me. The atrocity lies were poured into our skulls like molten metal. Even long after the defeat of William II, a large placard on the door of my parents' home continued to proclaim, "Nothing from the Germans, nothing to the Germans." For all that, I one day got an unexpected glimmer of the genuineness of these sentiments. In 1919, my father ordered some new tons to replace the copper equipment of our brewery, which had been turned into ammunition by the Germans. Not manufactured by the Germans, naturally, those monsters who cut off hands and poison candy, but from our dear allies, the worthy British. On the day they arrived, the entire local population accompanied the wagons transporting the enormous vats, which were brilliantly bedecked with ribbons. Curious, and struck with wonder at their size, I examined them with pride, until I discovered graven in the metal a large inscription which left me flabbergasted, "Made in Germany." Less naive than ourselves, our valiant British allies had, for a nice commission, fobbed off on us equipment manufactured by those spurned and sickening Germans, whom we had thought forever expelled from humankind. No doubt the British had never felt constrained to put much credence in the severed hands of Belgian children and in the murderous candy. These bloody legends were augmented by many others of the most varied kind. Another one which stirred the conscience of the world was the affair of the Belgian snipers. There is certainly no question that the Germans went all out in combat. That was the way wars were fought in those days, the military manners of the age. If soldiers were fired on by villagers, the village paid for it. Houses went up in flames. The presumed civilian aggressors, violators of the rules of land warfare of that era, were hunted down and often killed. The British had been no less quick to act in their campaigns in India, nor the Americans in their march westward, nor the French of Napoleon during the campaign in Spain, to judge by the atrocities immortalized by Goya. In the course of their dash across Belgium in August 1914, the Germans unquestionably killed a certain number of civilians who were not necessarily innocent and not necessarily guilty. The settling of accounts took place on the spot, in the heat of the moment. The Germans explained that when they were ambushed by civilians, they simply had to counter with severity. For me, a youngster 8 years old, one case was beyond dispute. In my little town of Bouillon, a neighbor took up a perch, armed with his rifle, atop a tall fir on the main road and fired on the Germans when they came into view. 3 days later, two other citizens of Bouillon fired on other enemy soldiers. So there were instances of Belgian sniping, at least those two. But to have spoken of it would have constituted a kind of treason. In August 1914, it was necessary to assert that not a single civilian had opened fire from ambush. The Belgian people had not taken any part in the sniping, nor fired on a single advancing German. Here, too, the contention took on the aspect of dogma. The Legend of the Snipers, that was the title of a hefty book sold throughout Belgium after the war. This tale of the massacre of completely innocent civilians thus became another international catchphrase of Allied propaganda. It took a very simple idea on the part of a German of rank who had been exasperated by these accusations to set matters straight. He was the Baron van der Lancken, a diplomat and very well known in Parisian society before 1914. Before him, no one thought of consulting the essential records, the files of the Germans who were wounded. In the military hospitals, every wounded man had a chart on which the nature of his wounds was noted. Van der Lancken made an exhaustive investigation of all the charts of the Germans wounded in Belgium in August 1914. He discovered that hundreds of the men had been wounded not by bullets or shrapnel, but by shotgun pellets. Everything was now clear. Those hundreds of Germans wounded by buckshot, as if they had been wild game, couldn't have been shot by French or Belgian or British soldiers, someone had to have fired at them with guns intended for the Sunday hunt. Hence the countermeasures, the ravaging of a few villages and towns where civilians had rashly shot at the Germans in contravention of international law. The Hague Convention was quite explicit, only soldiers who were recognizable as such were allowed to bear arms. Civilians were excluded from combat unless they wore a uniform or at the very least some distinctive and very obvious sign. Otherwise, the use of a weapon was and is grounds for execution. There was in Belgium a secondary category of impromptu combatants not authorized by the international conventions, the civil guards. The latter formed a sort of town militia that was prohibited from taking any part in the war. That express prohibition was emphasized to them on August 4, 1914, the first day of hostilities. Some of them did not comply and, armed with their old service rifles, here and there fired on the invaders, provoking bloody reprisals. The newspaper of these local guards, moreover, had a provocative name, Le Franc-Tireur, the sniper. But a sniper automatically places himself outside international law if he is not normally a member of the military units provided for by law in the event of war. It would be the same in 1940-1945, when Germans were many a time killed in Belgium, in Holland, and in France by members of the resistance, men disguised as civilians, indistinguishable from the general population, who disappeared once they had struck. Such attacks were outside international law. When irresponsible men commit them, Such illegal acts are sometimes dearly paid for, often by hostages in lieu of the attackers, who have disappeared. The primary culprit is the non-soldier who fires, wounds, or kills, not the soldier who takes justified reprisals. Such was the general case with regard to the civilians killed in Belgium in 1914. Every conceivable story was used to build up hatred during the course of the First World War. The Germans had been so barbarous, if you can imagine it, that they had everywhere deliberately cut down the apple trees of France. An accusation ridiculous on the face of it, but for a few less trees in the orchards of France or a few apples missing from the fruit seller's window, hysterical campaign would be unleashed with repercussions clear to the coral reefs of Australia and the glaciers of Greenland. What interest could the Germans possibly have in depriving the French of a few apple tarts? If it had been a question of corn or cattle, well and good, the Allies had no compunctions after the armistice of 1918 about requisitioning foodstuffs, including herds of cattle, in a starving Germany against which they had long maintained the cruelest of blockades. But apples? The stories of devastated orchards made no sense. The Germans, to be sure, now and then cut down trees that interfered with their artillery fire. All the armies of the world would do the same thing. In January 1983, in Lebanon, months after the cessation of hostilities, the Israelis were still cutting down groves of poplars that form a screen south of Beirut, limiting the field of vision at the approaches to the airport. In no way did the Germans commit graver crimes in chopping down a few fruit trees that were in the way. No matter. The few apples the French didn't get to bite into would be one more weapon in the arsenal of Allied propaganda. Not since Adam and Eve has a story about apples created such a hullabaloo. That is not to say there were no Germans here and they're capable of violence. There are savages in all countries, humanity is not a host of angels. The French, the Belgians, the British, the Americans, too, had their sadists who committed war crimes as often, and sometimes more, than the defeated Germans. The only difference is that the victors came out of the affair with glory, and instead of being condemned to death, reaped decorations, promotions, and liberal pensions. Three quarters of a century after the First World War, the accusations of cut-off hands, of civilians killed, of apple trees destroyed, which created such a stir at the time, appear almost insignificant today. What do they amount to alongside, not the legends, but the facts that the world has known since then? Facts such as the frightful terrorist bombings of Hamburg and Dresden and so many other German cities during the Second World War, bombings in which hundreds of thousands of defenseless civilians were carbonized. Or such as the atom bombings of the civilian population of a Japan that asked only to surrender. Each time the goal has been to create hate and counter-hate, an overriding objective in 1914 especially. In the month of August the war had ground to a halt, and it was necessary to keep the weary or disheartened people in a state of frenzied excitement. Hatred, the number one weapon, fired man's mind. What did it matter if there wasn't a word of truth to the horrifying stories? The propaganda rendered the Germans hateful, that was its only aim. The waves of that anti-German hatred still roll after three quarters of a century. Not that men still talk of cut-off hands, most people have never heard that tale. Young people look at you in amazement and even suspicion if you tell them about it. The stories of the snipers and the apple trees are no longer remembered either. Some people occasionally remember that Belgium, so often raped in the course of her history, was violated once again on 1914 by the Germans in their mad dash towards Paris. The particular hatreds created then no longer have their old vigor, but a dark and profound aversion to the Germans has stolen into the minds of millions since those days. Without genuine reason, they hate the Germans. They recognize that the Germans are first-rate as regards their factories and in their business dealings, that they gave the civilized world Goethe, Schiller, Derrida, Kant, Nietzsche, and Wagner. But for millions of non-Germans, the Germans are brutes, capable of anything. That summary judgment, born of the invented horrors laid to the Germans in 1914, has remained in the subconscious of the public. Let the occasion arise again, and that mentality is reborn at once, as we saw in 1940 to 1945. Anything at all will be believed if it is charged to the Germans. Whether it's a question of gas chambers in which, to believe the figures of the accusers, the victims would have to have been crowded together 32 persons per square meter 24 hours a day, or whether a description is being given to you of the crematory furnaces which, if they had to burn up all the bodies assigned to them by the Jewish propaganda, would still be working at full capacity in the year 2050, or even 2080. When it's a matter of denigrating Germans, nothing need be verified. Any testimony whatsoever, whether from liar, conman, swindler, or whether arrested from an accused person by torture, is swallowed with rapture. It has been decided in advance that Germans can't ever have been anything but dreadful cutthroats. Countless persons still unconsciously carry around the old complexes born of the hocus-pocus of 1914, accepting everything as true, however improbable, unreasonable, or even grotesque, without weighing or studying a thing. Those German monsters, they think. And the matter is settled. The strangest thing is that this hatred of the Germans is unique. Since 1789, French governments have far surpassed the Germans in horror. Napoleon didn't send the inhabitants of occupied countries to work camps, but to the hecatombs of his subsequent campaigns, 196,000 soldiers were conscripted by force in Belgium alone. In Spain, the French armies committed horrible atrocities. But no disparaging memory of the French nation is cultivated. It is the same with the British establishment, who steeped the whole world in blood in the course of subjugating its colonies and even carried out the total annihilation of a race in the mass murder of the Tasmanians. And the same is true of the American politicians, who took half of Mexico at the point of a gun and enslaved millions of blacks, and who exterminated hundreds of thousands of Japanese at Hiroshima and Nagasaki with frightful cruelty. If Truman and his backers had accepted Japan's surrender offer, instead of demanding unconditional surrender, all those lives would have been spared. When it is a question of non-Germans, such slaughters are the misfortunes of war. As news items, they are forgotten after a few decades. But for the Germans, the ordeal of their war crimes, true or false, is never over. Germany's sins, real or invented, are to be publicized until the end of time. The persistence of this hatred illustrates the force, and the frenzy, with which public opinion was poisoned by the Allied governments between 1914 and 1918, in order to stir up their people at home to fight and to recruit a maximum of cannon fodder from abroad. And to the extent to which the public was led astray in the Allied countries, the political and moral foundations of the Versailles Treaty of 1919 were inexorably established. By eliminating or inventing diplomatic documents, the Tsarist bureaucracy destroyed or faked some 80% of its foreign policy documents from 1914 to 1917, the Allied leadership convinced the world that the horrible Germans were solely and totally responsible for the War of 1914. On the day of reckoning, June 28, 1919 at Versailles, the barbarous Germans would pay the price of their total responsibility for the war. The Versailles Treaty of 1919, in the same spirit as the war, would be the treaty of vengeance against German crimes, for which no punishment would be sufficiently severe. But it would be a long and bloody road to Versailles. At year's end in 1914, on the mud and snow-clogged European fronts, millions of men worn out from suffering no longer had even the strength to imagine how they could ever extricate themselves from the mire in which the corpses of their enemies and their companions rotted by the tens, the hundreds of thousands. If the leaders of the slaughter intended to prolong the war at all cost, it would be necessary to procure immense quantities of raw materials, the stockpiling of which no one had given a thought to before the hostilities, since the war would certainly be of short duration. Above all, it was imperative to obtain millions of new soldiers, at little or no cost, no matter where or how, in Europe or outside of Europe, without regard for men's opinions, their freedoms, or their lives. From 1915 on, many people subjected to this slave trade would be sold at auction. 27 countries would be dragged into that insanity, to be sure, in the name of right. In the name of right, 32 million men would be maimed, from 1915 to 1918, 8 million dead would lie scattered and mangled in filthy mud all the way from the Isar to Mount Sinai. The quest for future cannon fodder began. First Turkey, then Italy, would be dragged into the affair.